Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
So well.
I'm well as well, and I'll tell you what. I've been spending a lot of time thinking about appreciating life as it goes by. 2009 was kind of a tough year, you know, in the economy. Honestly, in my personal life, I had some stuff that was going on. And since then, you know, things have gotten a lot better in a lot of different ways. But one of the things that I look at is every day that I'm alive, I appreciate what I've got. I know that sounds so corny. But I try. I really try, and I talk about this with...
Well, especially me knowing how unappreciative of most things you are.
I just don't tell you.
Okay, fair enough.
But there's, you know, there's great food in my life. I have great friends in my life and a great relationship. And, you know, I like my house. I like my... You know, it's just, I like... It's there's a lot of... And you got to focus on those things.
Sure, all the time you get to spend with me. That's got to make you feel good.
Well, there's stuff to get through as well. no, but, you know, I have an interesting career, and... You know, just but it's just a minute-by-minute things. And I, one of the things we've been doing a lot of public speaking, and one of the things that we've talked about a number of times, is the context of the good things in life. And putting and one of the things that we do is provide context. And I think that there are two lessons to the next story. And one of them is that we need to, that it's valuable. We bring a value when we provide context where people can take a moment. And I think what going to a restaurant and having a meal is, and what we help people do in the restaurants is, when you have a meal, to sit back and stop and relax. And when you come to a restaurant, you don't have to cook. You don't have to clean. I remember, you know, my father would say to my mother, sit down. Well, she couldn't sit down. She was doing all this stuff so we could have a good meal.
Busy. Right.
And, you know, it's sitting down and enjoying your friends and enjoying the moment and looking at wine and having a knowledgeable waiter who tells you what it is that your options are, what you're eating or how things work. And this story really spoke to me. And it's been around for a long time, but it came to me in an email. And here's the following email. It says, something to think about. And I checked this out on Snopes. This actually happened. It was in an old. It was in the newspapers. In Washington, D.C., at a metro station on a cold January morning in 2007, a man with a violin played six Bach pieces for about 45 minutes. During that time, about 2,000 people went through the station, most of them on their way to work. And after about 3 minutes, a middle-aged man noticed there was a musician playing. He slowed his pace and stopped for a few seconds and then hurried on to meet his schedule. About 4 minutes later, the first person dropped a dollar in the violinist's bucket. A woman threw money in the hat, and without stopping, she continued to walk. At 6 minutes, a young man leaned against the wall to listen, but then quickly looked at his watch and started to walk again. At 10 minutes, a three-year-old boy stopped, but his mother tugged him along. The kid stopped to look at the violinist again, but the mother pushed hard, and the child continued to walk, turning his head the whole time. This action was repeated by many other children, but every parent, without exception, forced the children to move on quickly. At 45 minutes, the musician had played continuously. In the 45 minutes, only six people stopped and listened for a short while. About 20 gave money but continued to walk at the normal pace. The violinist collected a total of $32. After an hour, he finished playing. It was silent. No one noticed. No one applauded. And there was no recognition at all. That man was Joshua Bell, certainly the world's greatest violinist, and one of the world's greatest living musicians. The Bach pieces were some of the hardest, most intricate, and most beautiful pieces in all of music, and he was playing on a $500,000 Stradivarius. And nobody noticed. And so what does that say about context and how important it is on the one hand? Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, number two, being open to see things out of context. I don't know that I would have stopped. You know, I think, well, if I had been there, I'd have stopped and applauded and put $100 in it.
Your train would have come and you'd gotten on it.
And my train would have come and I'd gotten on it. And it points out that Joshua Bell had played a few nights earlier in Washington to a sold-out crowd with average tickets of $100 a person. And there he was. He played for an hour in the violin station.
For $32.
For $32. And the kids, and that's a beautiful part of the story, and the kids stopped and looked and said, I don't know what that is, but that's something special. And, you know, I don't know. I think there's a life lesson there. And I think as a restaurateur, one of my jobs is to get people to stop and listen and to point out the violin.
Oh, no.
That's part of what we do. What? No violin in the restaurant. Don't worry about it.
I was actually much more worried that you were going to make me serve great meals down in the Subway.
No, what's the point? You only get $32. No, I think that we all should take the lesson that we need to be open to it more, and I think that we in the restaurant business need to take the lesson that what we do in providing people with context and helping them to take that minute or that moment to sort of experience what's there is as important or is really as important as what's there, as what's on the plate, as what's in the glass.
More important than what's eating in your car on the way to the meeting?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you've got the point. And on that note, we'll take a quick break. We'll be back with the Restaurant Guys in just a moment. You're listening to us on WCTCAM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Aki Kamazawa. Her food blog is Ideas in Food. She does a lot of consulting around the industry, but her exciting new book is also called Ideas in Food. She's written that with her husband, Alexander Talbot, and she joins us today from her home in Pennsylvania.
Aki, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Great, interesting book. It's so that everyone in the audience knows what it's about. It's basically the science behind basic cooking and why it works, and then really innovative ideas and how to use the principles of science to do real cooking. Did I get that about right?
You got that exactly right.
So where the hell do you come from, and where do these ideas come from? It's really cool stuff in this book.
Really, really unusual, too, for Francis and I to find a book that is really hitting new areas of – I mean, we read a million books a year. We get just about everything that goes out in print. So – it's unusual for us to find something that's, you know, treading new water.
Well, thank you. Gosh, where do we come from? The book is actually, we were approached, we used to do a column for Popular Science called Kitchen Alchemy, where we talked a little bit about food science and new trends in food. And we were kind of approached by Clarkson Potter to write a food science book. And so we took it as an opportunity to write the book that we always wanted to read when we were young cooks kind of climbing up the ladder. So for us, it's equal parts science and just really encouraging people to be creative and take the techniques and make them their own.
Now, you met when you were cooks in the kitchen at Clio, right?
Yes.
And so why don't you tell us about your professional background and what you mean by, you know, when you say, and I have a pretty good idea of what you're saying, is you're a young cook and you're taught these methods and you're taught how to do things, but maybe the why it works or why you have to do those things you may not understand as well as you would before you've read your book.
Well, I think, and the world has changed a lot in the last 12 years since I started cooking at Clio, but as a young cook, when you're working with chefs, I mean, everything in the restaurant world is busy, 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 busy. So you have time to learn how to do the things you need to do really well. And if you want to understand the hows and whys behind why you're doing things, a lot of times it falls on you to do that research in your spare time, to find the books and the information and learn, kind of continuing education in the restaurant business. And other than Harold McGee's book, I mean, 10 years ago there weren't that many resources. The internet was kind of just starting out, and people were holding their recipes pretty close. And it was really hard to learn about new things and to find out about new ingredients and get the kind of education that I think young cooks are really hungry for. So this book is kind of born of that desire to share and to help people really understand what's happening with their food and how to cook really great food and make it their own.
Well, I think for a young chef, this is going to be a very enlightening book. I remember being a kid in high school, college, and taking calculus classes and memorizing the formulas and working my way through the problems and doing what needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And I think I was in calculus for about 3 semesters plus a year in high school, and finally it dawned on me what I was doing what the purpose of what I was doing was. And I was like, you know, if somebody had just showed me that the first week I opened the book and said, okay, these are the kinds of things we're trying to accomplish with calculus, it would have made it so much easier for me. And one of the things that I think that this book helps to do is teach people that science of, well, this is what you're trying to do. You're trying to change the chemistry of the food in this certain way by cooking it this certain way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think even though when we first started writing it, we were kind of thinking of ourselves as young cooks, what we found is it's really great for experienced chefs as well, because it's kind of a different perspective. When you're working in your own kitchen and you're teaching other people for a long time, sometimes you forget to take that step back and really think about the hows and whys and kind of find that moment of creativity and that moment of fun, and that, you know, you get locked into the dishes that you're used to doing. And so a different perspective is always freeing.
Here's a question for you. When, because you really are on the cusp, if you started cooking 12 years ago, and we started our own restaurant 18 years ago, so we started 23 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you really started at the beginning of a new era and a new way of looking at food that we've had the good fortune to be a part of, but you began right at the cusp of it and have come up with it, and I think it's really beautiful that you've come up with this book to sort of chronicle where we are at this moment. My question to you, though, when you were starting as a cook, did you find that there were a lot of cooks, accomplished chefs, who knew how to do things, but even the very accomplished chef, they weren't not teaching the whys and wherefores of the chemistry of why certain things work to young cooks because they didn't have the time. I think very often they didn't know. By trial and error, they'd found techniques that worked. But do you think that people really understood, even accomplished chefs in the kitchen understood, the basic chemistry of what was happening in the various cooking processes?
Well, I would say that it depended on the chef, but the majority of them didn't. I don't think that they had any reason to really look for that information. I mean, a lot of traditional cooking was about technique and doing things that had been done before because people knew that they worked.
Right, sure. Well, if you don't understand why it exactly works, it's very hard to say, okay, well, I know this technique works, but the reason it works is because it's accomplishing X, Y, and Z chemically, so I can accomplish those things by another route. If you don't know what it's doing chemically, it's just a matter of, well, in order to get my sauce to taste sweeter and have this mouthfeel, I have to go through these steps, and it's sort of
mm-hmm.
a rote thing, you know?
Yes, exactly.
So who's using your book? Is it the home cook, or is it people in restaurants? Is it people who are using it to experiment in new ways or to perfect old ways? Who's using this book?
Well, I would like to think that all of those people are using the book. I think that anyone who has a passion for food and a curiosity about the way things work can really benefit from reading it. I know that I've been very surprised. Like, we've gotten feedback from a lot of different people, and we've gotten people sent us pictures of things that they're cooking from the book, which is really exciting for us to see. And a lot more home cooks than maybe people would have expected are actually picking up the book. I will say that people either love us or they hate us. But
why would they hate you? What is the possible complaint about your book? I'm curious.
Well, you know, we take a very modern approach to cooking, and we include a lot of equipment. We include circulators and pressure cookers, which actually are not really modern, but they are enjoying a renaissance and are coming back. And people feel like the book is a little too technical and too equipment heavy. And, you know, in the second part of the book for professionals, we talk about hydrocolloids, which are basically just different types of thickeners. And a lot of people in this time of locavores and cooking naturally and getting back to our roots take issue with that and feel like we're telling them to use chemicals and additives. And that mentality is exactly what we're trying to kind of break through by bringing the information to people. Because when you think of ingredients as chemicals, you're automatically prejudiced against them. But if you think of things as ingredients, then you understand that you can use them and you can make really good ingredients better.
Well, and I'm going to help you answer that as somebody who, you know, Francis and I are into the local locavore movement and sustainability and purity of ingredients. And what I'll tell you is So those people can look at 90% of this book and say, wow, there's some really cool things in there, and maybe I don't want to participate in the other 10% of those types of things. But well, let's get into I think there's some really cool areas that you get into that certainly people like Francis and I would be really into. I mean, you talk about making your own vinegars. I mean, I remember as a kid.
Really hard to find that controversial. Those damn modern vinegar makers.
I mean,
that's true.
I found not so long ago my great grandmother's vinegar jars that they brought over, that she brought over, her family brought over on the boat from Italy with them. I found them in my aunt's cupboard. Of course, they were filled with M&Ms or something, something like that. But, you know, when I was a kid, my grandmother made her own vinegar. And, you know, when the wine went bad or you know, any of the other things that you might put into vinegar, any of the other vinegars, apple ciders or anything like that went bad, they became part of that ever-evolving vinegar that we used in the household, and it was mm-hmm. one vinegar. We didn't have, you know, 6, 7, 10 vinegars like it sounds like you have running at any one time. But, you know, that was something that was cultural and important to the household, and we've kind of fallen away from, and you show us how to do that again in this
so
book, don't you?
Talk to us about vinegar, because while all of our listeners are gonna click onto the Internet and buy your book immediately, some of them haven't read it yet. Talk to us about vinegar.
Vinegar is actually one of our favorite ingredients, and I think people underestimate how important acidity is in balancing food. And when you make homemade vinegars, you can make vinegars that have very unusual and complex flavors that you can't get from a store-bought vinegar. And it's always interesting to work with people who are used to either a sweet or a salty palate and reintroduce them to vinegar and the acidity and how it really brightens up food and makes it pop and taste so much better. Because recently I was working with a woman and she was trying to make a vinaigrette and it was kind of flat and it needed sweetness. And so she was looking to go add some sugar to the vinaigrette. And I was like, no, get the vinegar. And she thought I was absolutely insane, but we were working with a fruit juice. I think we were working with yuzu juice. And so I knew that the sweetness was in there, and it was just kind of a question of unlocking it. And so we added a little bit of vinegar. I think it was red wine vinegar. And it just kind of brought all the sweetness in the juice out. But it also added a little bit of its own complexity and flavor. And I think that vinegar is just a wonderful ingredient.
But one of the things that I think that your book really shows people is how simple an ingredient vinegar is to make. It's really,
yeah.
It's not that complex. It's not that hard to take care of. It's not that hard to let grow. And that, frankly, your house vinegar will get better and better and better and better over time.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And, you know, we kind of grew up in this culture of not wanting to waste things. And sometimes, you know, you've got a glass of wine left or you've got a half of a beer left or something like that, and you don't really want to throw it away, and you sit there and you're like, well, I could finish it, but I don't really want it, but you could make it into this wonderful vinegar.
So just briefly go over with people how you make a vinegar from your leftover half bottles of wine and glasses of wine and beer and how you would use a living vinegar at home.
Basically, you want to get a nice big glass jar. If you're gonna seriously make vinegar at home, if you get a glass jar, like a lemonade jar that has a spigot at the bottom, those are perfect. And you can start with a little bit of apple cider vinegar because that tends to have a natural mother in it, and the mother is what sort of consumes all of the alcohol and the sugar and turns your wine into vinegar.
It's a bacteria. You can say it.
For you old Italians, it's the big, gloppy, slimy thing that would be in the middle of the vinegar.
It's a bacteria, right?
The mother.
We call it the mother. But
we do call it the mother. But, you know, it reproduces, so it's actually a good name. And you just keep adding all of your leftover wine to your glass jar, and it will very quickly, it will start to smell like vinegar as it ferments, and within a couple of weeks, you can taste it, and you can buy all kinds of fancy equipment, and you can test your vinegar for certain acid levels and this and that, but really, you can go by your palate, and it will start to taste like vinegar, and it will start to be tangy and complex, and the alcohol flavor will disappear, and then you can start using it. It's that simple.
And the belief would be that as your mother got older and older and older, and it would the flavors would intensify, and it would become, like I said, there were like a palate of the house, and mm-hmm. so parents, mothers would actually break off a piece of their mother, give it to the daughters to start, so they could start their vinegar and have it kind of come from the same cuvee that the first vinegar came from, and you could continue to kind of break it off and, you know, produce more and more vinegars from that one basic mother, which could sometimes be, you know, years and years and years old.
Absolutely.
Now, you have to keep it in the dark, but here's the question that I have for you is, if you have a vinegar working, if you add new alcohol to that, then you know, say you've got another half bottle of wine, you just add it to that, or do you sequester when the vinegar is done? Do you bottle some vinegar that's finished and then not touch it for a while until it finishes again?
Once I have a good amount of vinegar, I will usually pour off a bottle to keep for use in the kitchen.
And then when you freshen up the vinegar with the mother in it again, you don't touch it for a while again until that alcohol is consumed?
Exactly. I mean, if you're adding small amounts, it's not going to make a huge difference. Like if you have 2 quarts of vinegar and you're adding a half a cup here and there, you're still going to be pretty much fine using it. But if you're adding large amounts of wine, then you want to kind of sequester your vinegar and have like a working batch and a batch that's fermenting.
First. Yeah, again, in our family, it was such a big, I mean, it was literally a big pot, 5-8-gallon pot of vinegar. Mm-hmm. You would add a cup of wine or 2 cups of wine, it would really not have much of an impact on the vinegar.
My first experience with vinegar was back in 1996. I was in Austria, and I was motorcycling around with my friend Peter Schleimer, who's a wine critic. And he had different mothers in different places. He had some at his parents' house and some in a storage unit because he felt the mothers got very similar if they were together, but if they remained geographically distant, the mothers remained different.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a wine writer for an Austrian magazine called Vinaria, where he's now the editor-in-chief of that magazine. But he would, you know, get sample bottles sent to him all the time of all sorts of different wines. And so he had, you know, he said, you know, as a wine critic, I can't possibly consume all these wines, and some of them are very, very expensive. And so he had these great vinegars made from these tremendous wines. And I think that, you know, this is also something you can give to someone as a present that is really speaks of you. It's something that you made in your house, and I think these things are really wonderful. And now, if I want to give someone a bottle of vinegar, if there's no visible mother in the vinegar, will it resurrect if I give it to someone, or do I need to take off a piece of that mother to give them a cloudy vinegar in order for it for them to reproduce it?
In my experience, it will resurrect. I've never had a problem with adding a homemade vinegar to something and having it not ferment.
Live. Crazy.
Vinegar begets vinegar.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back with some more complex ideas in food with Aki Kamazawa. Her book has the same name. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the restaurant guys sent you. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest is Aki Kamazawa. Her book is Ideas in Food. Her food blog has the same name. You can find out all of that on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And, okay, the book, I found a whole lot of new fascinating things. What did you find most surprising in your research for the book or in your research overall? What did you find? What have you found that was sort of counterintuitive and surprising about food in culling your ideas together like this?
Counterintuitive and surprising. That's a good question. I think, wow, you've stumped me a little bit. I think a lot of things that I found counterintuitive, I'd say more in the meat cooking sections, and I've always kind of believed in cooking in lower temperatures and cooking more slowly, but I think that as we did a little more research about meat and the way meat cooks and the things that happen with the muscle fibers, I found it interesting exactly how low temperatures really could be and what a difference it made to the results.
So
I mean,
how low can they be and what difference does it make to the results? That was an easy one.
Yeah, I guess it is kind of an easy one. I mean, the lower really, it's almost the lower the better. But if you cook a braise at 350 degrees and you cook a braise at 200 degrees, you're going to get very different results. And the braise that's cooked at 200 degrees is going to be, to my taste, it's just, it still has more flavor than the one that's cooked at a higher temperature. And the meat is a little bit softer and juicier. And I think that sometimes the idea of cooking at low temperatures is counterintuitive because we've always been, you know, you come up with sanitation and the health department and, you know, you have to hit 165 degrees and you have to keep everything out of the temper danger zone. And cooking with circulators and sous vide cooking has really taught us that you don't have to hit those really high temperatures and that you can be very gentle with your food and very precise with your cooking, and it makes a very big difference in your final results.
Without being too technical, tell us what the difference between that, you know, cooking at 200 degrees to 365 degrees. What's scientifically, what's going on differently in the meat at those two temperature levels?
Well, a big part of what happens is you heat up protein is, you think of protein as, the muscle fibers, basically they tighten up, and as they tighten up, they squeeze out the juice, and then they squeeze out the fat. So the more quickly you heat up your meat, the more quickly your muscle fibers are going to tighten up, and the more of the juice and the fat you're going to lose. So a slow, gentle cook is going to allow your meat to hang on to more of what makes it taste good.
Well, on quite the opposite end of the spectrum, I found something very interesting on the opposite end of the temperature spectrum in your discussions of freezing and flash freezing and how that works. So why don't you talk to us about how you use freezing to enhance the character or short-term freezing at least to enhance the character of some of the foods that you talk about.
Freezing is actually, it's a wonderful tenderizer for food. And basically what happens when you freeze food is that ice crystals form. And the faster you freeze your food, the smaller the ice crystals, which is good because smaller ice crystals do less damage to the cell walls. So that when you defrost the food, it becomes tender. And if you freeze and thaw too many times, you get freezer burn and you lose a lot of liquid. But if you can do your freezing very quickly, then you can just perfectly tenderize your food. And then if you take that one step further and you freeze something in a brine or something that's been cured, what happens is as the ice crystals form and the food is tenderized, then as it's kind of resting in its liquid after it defrosts, it pulls the flavor back into your fruit or your vegetable. So if you wanted to, say, make a quick pickle, you could actually freeze your lemons. If you want pickled lemons, you could freeze your lemons in their cure and then defrost them. And it will actually help them break down more quickly and absorb all of the flavors more quickly.
You know, I had an interesting experience, and you've just helped to explain why, although I sort of had an intuitive sense of it. But one of the things you talk about in the book is you talk about if you freeze things slowly, you get these large crystals that rip big holes in the cell walls of the fruits or vegetables.
And they defrost, and when they defrost, they leave whatever the thing that was frozen as water, that drips out, and you're left with large holes.
Well, and the holes sort of compromise the structure is why they get flabby and mushy. But if you can freeze it very quickly, what you're saying is a bunch of perfect little holes actually help to tenderize things. And I found I was trying to make a drink that a friend of mine actually came up with, and we made a couple of good ones in the summer, and couldn't reproduce it. And it used fresh cranberries, and the fresh cranberries, we'd muddle them in the bottom of a container, couldn't get consistently juice out of them unless they came right off the farm like that day.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, commercial cranberry juice is good, and we used some commercial cranberry products, and they were good, but it wasn't the same as that fresh cranberry I had right off the farm. Turns out, if you freeze those cranberries and then thaw them, you get these juicy cranberries that will muddle up very easily in the bottom of your cocktail shaker. And so I read your book, and it was very much like it was something I knew how to do, but I didn't know why. And so I had one of those, aha, that's why that works. Like, so it was a really aha moment for me.
Awesome.
So besides vinegar, and my question with vinegar is, you talk a lot about how vinegar works in various foods. We recently did a seminar at a game conference here, a outdoor sportsman's hunters game conference around here, and we talked about the subject of marinades and marinades that have oil in them and marinades that have acid in them, like a vinegar in a marinade. Marinade is one of those chemical things that people have used for a long time, but you have some pretty good advice for people as to how to not use them improperly, or how marinades can sometimes cook your food or not. Why don't you talk to us about that?
Well, marinades really are characterized by the fact that they have acid added to them, so vinegar or citrus juice or something like that. And they work best with thinner pieces of meat because you don't really want to leave them in the marinade long enough to actually have it penetrate a thick piece of meat. It adds flavor, and it also tenderizes because the acid reacts with the protein on the surface of the meat and makes it and kind of denatures it, breaks it down a little bit, and allows it to absorb more of the flavor and also breaks it down a little bit so that it becomes a little bit more tender when you cook it.
And you can leave things – one of the things that I find home cooks do very often is they'll marinate things too long. They'll marinate overnight in something that has a strong acidity. And it basically cooks and toughens it if you leave it in too long, right?
Yes, it does. It cooks it. In some cases, it toughens it, and in some cases, it makes it kind of fall apart and become slimy. It depends on the protein. But what I've found with home cooks is sometimes they just think more is better as opposed to figuring out. You just want to add exactly the right amount.
Yeah, figuring out when it's done. Well, if you would like to find out more about why the things that work for you, and find maybe some new ways of doing things, you should check out Ideas in Food. It's a book by Aki Kamazawa, who's our guest today, and Alexander Talbot, her husband. There's also Ideas in Food, which is the blog. You can look that up as well. And Aki, thanks for coming on the show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, and we'll be back in just one moment at WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Smart book, smart lady, smart, cool stuff.
You know, one of the cool chapters in here is about cold soaking pasta prep.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Basically putting whatever macaroni you're going to use in a cold soak. And the idea of the cold soak being that you can flavor that however you'd like and have your macaroni take up the cold soak and then also be prepped. So in a restaurant experience, you can then cook that macaroni in 60, 90 seconds, make it happen really quickly with whatever flavors you wanted that were already in the cold smoke.
Which cold soak?
Cold smoke. cold soak.
Nice.
Just like you said, yes. Three tries.
You know, that's different than par cooking,
because
when you par cook pasta, which is you sort of get it most of the way there so you can finish it at the last minute, you've really begun the cooking process rather than just the hydrating process.
Correct.
So I don't know. I'm fascinated by that, and we're going to give it a try.
Oh, we're definitely going to see what happens. I'm curious also to see what happens when you cold soak it. Will some of that flavor then leach back out into the water?
But you left out an important step. Aki's book talks about is in the cold soak you can put flavorings
in the water.
So you don't have to soak it in a gallon of water. You soak it in sufficient water to hydrate it, and in that water you can have flavorings that will then go into the pasta
sure,
with the water.
Be it parsley or whatever you want, whatever pepper, whatever you want to flavor into the macaroni.
And I just think that's a fascinating idea.
We're
going to
play around with it, and we'll get back to this.
And if
sure.
we start doing it at the restaurant, we're not going to tell anybody. Just gonna be like, oh, it's a magic trick. It's how it works. No problem. Well, anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.